Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We have no plans to invade Armenia. Why would we do that? What is the point? Absolutely, that is the message the Azerbaijanis want to get out. This is nonsense. We're not planning to do it.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Battle Lines.
Regardless of who stands with Israel, Israel will fight until this battle is won.
I've made wartime decisions. I know the choices are never clear or easy for the leadership.
I just find bombs and I find dead people, but it's a really scary thing for me.
In this episode of Battle Lines, I speak to The Telegraph's chief political correspondent, Camilla Turner, and US editor, Tony Diver, on an alleged Chinese hacking plot against the UK and the US. Then, we speak to senior foreign correspondent Sophia Yan about her visit to Latvia to understand how the Baltic nations are mobilizing to counter any future attack by the Russian Federation. Finally, I speak to our senior foreign correspondent Roland Oliphant on the rising tensions after decades of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It's Friday, the 29th of March, 2024. Camilla, high drama in London this week as the UK revealed what it says is a global Chinese hacking plot. How did this story come out?
So this story actually first emerged on Sunday. The Sunday Times reported that there was going to be a sort of major announcement coming the next day from Oliver Dowden, as well as a private briefing for a small group of MPs who had been spied on by China. Then on Monday, the big announcement came in the House of Commons, which was Oliver Dowden saying that there had been a major hack of the Electoral Commission system, and that hack had actually been announced a while ago, but the blame hadn't been attributed to Chinese state-backed hackers until this week. And this was absolutely huge. It meant that for around a year, these Chinese hackers had access to the personal data of 40 million people in the UK. So a really widespread attack there. And then the second element was that a group of MPs had been spied on by Beijing and they'd been briefed about their own personal security. The upshot of all of this was a new wave of sanctions announced on both Chinese individuals and also a company. And that element of it was coordinated with America, who also announced sanctions at the same time.
So hacking the Electoral Commission, spying on MPs, do we know what the Chinese are actually trying to do? Do you have any sense of what their strategy is? Why are they hacking these things? What are they looking for?
So the MPs they were hacking, what they all had in common was that they were all China hawks. So these are all MPs and also a peer as well, who all have been outspoken on China and critical on China. One can only assume that the intention there was perhaps to intimidate them, to gather intelligence on them. Ian Duncan Smith, former leader of the Conservative Party, was one of the MPs that had been spied on. And he actually divulged that in the past, he knows that Chinese hackers have tried to impersonate him and to have actually sent emails to contacts and colleagues of his all around the world, sort of saying, oh, hello, I'm Ian Duncan Smith and I recant my views on China. I've got it all wrong. So obviously part of it is probably them trying to sort of sow seeds of mistrust and kind of undermine the critics of the regime.
And what were the reactions across the UK and in governmental spheres, maybe the security spheres? How did people react to this news?
It was quite a big announcement in the sense that, of course, some of these operations were slightly historic, like the hack on the Electoral Commission website actually took place back in August 2021, and the hack took place for over a year. So it was slightly historic, but nonetheless, the fact that the government was kind of solidly blaming China for it all. That seemed like quite a big step. And then for those MPs who are more on the hawkish side of things, I suppose this really emboldened them to say, well, why aren't we doing more? Why aren't we labelling China more of a threat? Why aren't we taking more steps to sort of secure ourselves and protect ourselves against this quite massive state-backed operation to try and bring parts and systems down?
Thank you so much, Camilla. Tony, over to you. How was this story broken in the US and what was the US government's response?
Well, the announcement in the Commons coincided with the Department of Justice over here sending out a notice saying that they were sanctioning the same individuals that were sanctioned in the UK and that they were also bringing a prosecution against seven of them. And the most interesting part, perhaps, of the US side of this story are the people who were targeted. So alongside critics of China within the Congress, we also saw White House officials who were hacked, members of the administration, State Department, and people who worked for political campaigns on both sides, that's Biden and Trump at the 2020 election. So we saw actually pretty widespread attempts to disrupt what was going on over here over the last 4 years or so. And the other thing we got, David, from the American release was a lot more detail about who these people actually are and what the group we're talking about really is. This group, which is known in the cybersecurity and intelligence community as APT-31, stands for Advanced Persistent Threat 31, although by some of the private sector, it's been given the rather more sexy nickname, Violet Typhoon. And this group of people work for what is essentially a front company, which is really operated by the Chinese security services. And their job is to try and infiltrate the information networks of people in the West who've been critical of China or people whose information could be useful to the Chinese government by sending them spam emails and basically gaining access to their networks of contacts and to their email accounts. So we got a pretty long list of things that these people are meant to have done from the Americans, and that perhaps sheds a bit more light on what exactly was going on in the UK.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a step back and put this in some context. I mean, it doesn't feel that long since, you know, former Prime Minister David Cameron was sharing a pint with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, in Britain's sort of great detente and warming of relations with China. We're a long way from that now. Can you, both of you really, like, would you like to sort of add details to that, sketch out how that relationship has changed maybe since that moment?
So I suppose the UK's relationship with China has, you know, it's been kind of ebbs and flows over the years. I think with this latest revelation about this kind of massive hacking attack, as well as the spying on MPs, I think what this has led a lot of MPs to call for is really an end of a kind of business as usual economic relationship with China, given the kind of scale of the targeting of both the kind of British institutions as well as individual MPs. Now, of course, that's perhaps easier said than done, given that China is such a massive economy and it's difficult to suddenly completely disengage with such a massive economy all at once. But certainly those calling for a shift in our relationship and for the government to really recognise China as being a kind of threat to our national security and treating it as such, that's something that some of the more hawkish MPs are really calling for. And I think something we will start to see a slight shift of the government's position on, even the fact that they decided to really just publicly call out China for both the spying and the cyber attacks. That in itself is a shift in position, because I suppose it didn't need to. It could have just kept that to itself. But the fact that they're wanting to loudly and clearly lay the blame on China for these attacks probably is perhaps the first step in a shift of our relationship with the country.
Tony, do you want to add to that? When I mentioned there, former Prime Minister David Cameron's pints with Xi Jinping, he's now, of course, Lord Cameron. He is the Foreign Secretary. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the changing relationship here.
Yeah, well, it's quite ironic in a way, isn't it, that David Cameron, who oversaw what they called the golden age of Britain's relationship with China, is now the man who has to front the statements which say that they've been hacking a load of British MPs and a load of American officials on top. I think there has been a pretty major shift in the way that the government talks about China. We did see last year Liz Truss, who was Prime Minister, as you remember, for all of about 5 minutes, was a lot more critical of China. She was the only one who's been willing to label China a threat. And that's one of the big debates going on in the Conservative Party at the moment, as to whether or not the word threat is being used to talk about China's attitude towards Britain. We haven't seen Rishi Sunak do that, but I think we are seeing a shift in government policy towards being more cautious about China, talking about, rather euphemistically, about the UK's competition with China. And by that, we're not really talking about economic competition, because of course there's a vast difference in scale, but we are talking about security competition and perhaps defense competition. I think on the US side, we've seen the American administration be far more willing to go a lot further in talking about China as a threat. And we saw last year, last March, Avril Haines, who's the US Director of National Security, said that Chinese Communist Party represents the leading and most consequential threat to US national security. Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, has also said that China is the greatest long-term threat to the US. It's worth pointing out that anything that the UK does in terms of global security and the West versus the East is always done under the auspices of the American intelligence services. And I think we have seen the Americans be a lot more willing to be explicit about those threats in the last few years.
Just before we start to wrap this section up, how do you think this news might play in the American presidential election?
Well, a recent poll that was conducted for The Telegraph found that in a list of potential adversaries that the US faces, China is by far the one that Americans are most concerned about, ahead of Russia, ahead of North Korea. So I think this will be a major feature of the election, the threat from China. And as we all know, Donald Trump has been very vocal about the threats from China and about the US's policy. We saw Joe Biden meet Xi Jinping for the first time in a year at the end of last year at a summit in California. And he had to tread a very cautious line between explaining how there could be some economic benefit to the US interacting with China, also how they compete economically with each other, and then the way that the US can defend itself from some of these threats. I think we will see this on the campaign trail again and again, particularly from Donald Trump, who has accused Joe Biden of being the Manchurian candidate in this election. In other words, the candidate who is in the pocket of China, who won't be tough enough on them, and potentially expose Americans to some of those threats. So yeah, I think, you know, the Chinese debate is much more pertinent in the American political cycle than it is in the UK. And I think we can expect that to continue.
And what's the Chinese reaction to this news coming out? What's that been?
Well, we had a statement from the Chinese embassy in London, which came after the announcement by Oliver Dowden in the Commons. The Chinese embassy said that this was all lies. They said it was a malicious libel by the UK against China. They accused the UK and US of making up all of these allegations. And then they said that there will be some kind of diplomatic response towards British diplomats in China because of it. Now, obviously, this whole hacking ring is constructed to such a level of complexity that China can have some kind of deniability, right? It's a front company operated sort of three rungs away from the Communist Party itself, and they have attempted to deny it. I think it's pretty unlikely that the US and the Americans and the Brits would be going over the top to accuse them of that if they weren't dead sure that it was China who was doing it. But the diplomatic response has been one basically of denial.
And just finally then, what happens now? Is there anything consequential that we can talk about that might change in terms of policy? Or is at the moment, is it sort of more noise signifying nothing?
There is one further step the UK government are currently considering. It's something that's kind of being looked at by multiple different departments, which is whether to put China on this enhanced list. It's a sort of a new mechanism that's only come into force in theory, but not yet in practice. And essentially, it's about subjecting Chinese nationals who are perhaps carrying out low-level spying in the UK, subjecting them to much higher controls, potential 5-year jail sentences, and really just being much more stringent on the kind of low-level spying activity that other countries are doing all the time. And with kind of friendly nations or allies, it's not at all a problem. But this new enhanced list will mean that if China is put on it, that there are much more stringent kind of consequences for sort of low-level spying taking place here in the UK. And that's something that the government are quite keen to do and are currently going through the various approval processes to make it happen.
Anything to add to that, Tony?
I would just say on the US side, the big concern from the administration over here is not necessarily about these politicians who are being hacked, although that is worrying. It's about potential Chinese cyber hacks on critical national infrastructure. You know, Americans going to buy their petrol from a petrol station or get their water when they turn the taps on. That's the thing that really keeps people up at night. And we did see last month a warning in the latest National Security Review that was happening a lot more, and that China was trying to build those networks and trying to kind of infect the national infrastructure of the US. So I think in terms of where the story goes, something like that, which goes beyond the political sphere and into the civilian sphere, is, you know, potentially a lot more significant than what we've seen so far. But I also think we could expect to see some more political response and the US to potentially toughen its position on China even further.
Our listeners have heard all of this. What can they do? What can we tell them? How do we stay safe from Chinese cyber hacking?
Well, the mechanism that was used in this case was to send people emails purporting to be someone else, in this case purporting to be journalists, make them open the email, believe that the contents of the email was true, and click a link, which then gave these hackers access to the networks of the people who they were targeting. I would say, for listeners concerned about the cybersecurity, the most important thing you can do is monitor who is sending you what. If you see something that looks suspicious, check the email address. Don't open emails that look suspicious. And obviously, there are authorities that you can report these things to if you are concerned that you have been a victim of a Chinese hack.
Tony Diver and Camilla Turner, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Baltic states, that's Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, lie on the eastern edge of the European Union. They are NATO members and have a shared history of Soviet and Russian oppression and occupation. After 2 years of the war in Ukraine, the Baltic states are alarmed by what they see as an expansionist and imperial Russia. Our senior foreign correspondent, Sophia Jan, visited Latvia to understand how the state is thinking strategically about its future. Here's our conversation. Sophia Jan, thank you so much for your time. We're talking about your recent trip to Latvia. Why did you go to Latvia and what did you find?
I went to Latvia to chase a number of different stories, and one of them was to look at how the country is preparing as the risk of Russia is still one of a big concern. I had an interview with the Latvian foreign minister, Krišjānis Kariņš, and he made the very obvious point that even if the war with Ukraine were to end right now, Russia would still be a threat, particularly for the Baltic states. And so he was taking me through what the country is doing in terms of defense preparations and deterrence over this long-term worry that Latvia and its neighboring countries, Estonia to the north, Lithuania down to the south, just flanking Latvia, that all three of these countries and perhaps other European nations are at risk of invasion by Russia.
Could you put Latvia's sort of strategic thinking into a bit more context? You mentioned the war in Ukraine. Russia is obviously the big neighbor to the east. Could you flesh that out for a little for us? How are they thinking about their position in the world?
Well, what's really interesting about these three countries, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, if you take a look on the map, you'll see that the northwest border of these countries is flanked by the Baltic Sea. It's all water. And then on the other side, together, they share the longest NATO border with Russia and Belarus. It runs about 1,000 miles long. Just down with Lithuania, there's a tiny, tiny bit, about a 60-mile land strip on the border between Poland and Lithuania. This is the only part of this long border, this 1,000-mile border with these three countries that is not right up against Russia and Belarus. But itself, it's flanked to the west by the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad and to the east by Belarus. So it's a choke point. These countries are so worried about what could happen because it wouldn't take very much to cut them off entirely. So if Moscow were to seize the strip, the Suwalki Gap, this land strip I've mentioned, it's considered NATO's Achilles heel. Essentially, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania would be severed from their NATO allies. So there's been a lot of discussion amongst these three states about how to partner, to work together and to cooperate to ensure that, as the foreign minister said to me, quote, European defenses are completely up to snuff, and that it's not possible to have any gains without tremendous loss and to make sure actually that no gains would be feasible. That's the message they want to send to Russia. So what they're trying to do is to figure out how to secure that border. And this border is very interesting in that it doesn't have very many geographical obstacles. It's pretty open. And when you're looking on the map, there are highways that link up all the major cities, the capitals of the Baltic states, into Russian cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg. So you could imagine the Russian military just getting on one of these roads and rolling straight into one of these countries. This is the worst case scenario from the perspective of Latvia and Estonia and Lithuania. And so it's trying to figure out what would work at this point, because also these states have sent a lot of their stockpile of weapons and ammunition over to support Ukraine. So now they're thinking about how to prepare, how to replenish what they've got on hand, if ever needed, whether there are other weapon systems that need to be procured, how to train their people in case of war, to get people in for military training, things like this. There's a lot of long-term thinking and planning. And by long-term, I mean about 5 years. This is about the time frame that Latvian government officials have told me that they're thinking about. From the perspective of these Baltic states, there really needs to be some partnership. Because, for instance, if Estonia does something that Latvia doesn't do, or Latvia does something that Lithuania doesn't do, is there a weak link amongst these three nations? And if so, would that be something that Russia exploits? And so that's why you see a lot more discussion and thinking about how these countries ought to be working in concert with each other to deal with what they consider this very much looming threat from Russia.
Well, let's get into the detail then. Can you take us through some of the concrete changes the Latvians maybe, and also, as you said, working together with the Lithuanians to the south and the Estonians to the north, what concrete things are they doing right now?
So there was an agreement very recently to fortify a common defense line. And the idea is, Estonia's talked about it a little bit more publicly, but to build hundreds of bunkers and other defensive installations along this frontier area. And experts I spoke to say the idea is to be able to have some sort of defense in this open geographical area, what I was talking about in terms of a lack of natural obstacles, if there were an event, if there were the event of invasion, to find a way to make it harder for the Russian military to advance. And in fact, to try to channel them into certain areas, potential quote unquote kill zones, so that there would be a diversion of where Russian troops could go and then make it easier for the Baltic nations to then launch their counteroffensive, if it were really to come to that. So there's discussion of this kind of cooperation. In Latvia, conscription has been brought back as of January. Now, Latvia was the only nation that didn't have this already. Estonia has never stopped conscription. Lithuania stopped for a few years, but brought it back after Crimea. And Latvia is now the last one to re-up this. So as of January, this is something that applies to everyone, including Latvian males who live outside of the country. So people will be given a monthly salary of up to 300 euros. They're housed in army barracks. They get up to 1 month's leave. And the idea is to make sure that everyone is prepared for a potential emergency scenario. These are all the things that Latvia is doing on top of procuring new weapon systems like the HIMARS rocket system. This has been a key part of Ukraine's defense against Russia. And so there's a lot of thinking about how to develop not just the human side, the human resource capability of the military, but also to think about what sort of weapons systems might be useful going forward and what could be a deterrent for Russia. What could give Moscow, what could give Putin some pause in his thinking about what next?
Sophia, what did the civilians you met make of all of these measures?
So I got into a car from Riga. I drove about 4 hours east from the capital in the direction of Russia. So I saw these roads that go straight into Russian cities like Moscow, like St. Petersburg. And when you're driving on these roads, the signs also say Moscow. I literally drove in the direction of Moscow. And I went to the border towns to see how people are feeling about exactly that, this issue of Russia. And border areas have always fascinated me. The towns that I went to, one of which was just 3 miles from the border to Russia, I met people who had relatives fighting in both the Ukrainian and the Russian militaries. It's a very big issue for border communities like this, because you have to think, before these borders were in place, this was all under, and people were moving back and forth pretty freely. There are Russians settled in Latvia, for instance, a complicated place to be. And for people there, there's a lot of a wide range of opinion about what the country is doing. Some people feel that it's really very necessary. I met one young man, Matisse Lopsa. He said he had heard that the government might bring back the draft. And so he actually decided to volunteer for their version of the National Guard. He said, at least I can do this on my terms now and get the training, because once I do this, I won't be called in. I won't be conscripted in suddenly. I wouldn't be so surprised. And he thinks it's actually, as he said, quote, a very good way to discipline young men. He's all for it. And he felt it was necessary because then, quote, you won't be caught short on the first day, not physically knowing how to do anything. So for him, it's a way to prepare. And he thinks it's good training. Some other people don't feel the same. There are people who think the government could be doing more in terms of social services. And they feel like they shouldn't be giving up their children for something like this. And so there is a very wide range of thinking about whether or not this is necessary. Some people feel that even this kind of preparation is not enough to deter Russia. Some people, particularly the older generation, some of the elderly people I met along the border, really professed a sadness that in this world today, we're faced with these wartime conversations and these wartime, this kind of planning. This is something that for a lot of people, for them, they thought this was all behind them. And so it's a very interesting period of time to be wandering these border areas close to Russia because, you know, we're now more than 2 years in with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I will just repeat again what the Latvian foreign minister said to me, that even if that war were to end today, right now, Russia is still a threat and it's still a concern. And so the question is, how do you prepare and how do you find a way to deter that possible threat?
Yeah, it's a spooky feeling, isn't it, Sophia? I remember last summer when I was down in near Kharkiv and seeing the signs to Belgorod, which is obviously on the Russian side of the border, but it was only about 40 kilometers away. I thought, oh gosh, I'm getting a bit close. Sophia, when you were leaving Latvia, what conclusions did you draw from your trip there that you could share with us?
I would say that from the government's perspective, there's almost nothing that is too much in terms of preparing at this moment. They're really thinking with a forward-looking eye to what could happen. But then if you're looking and speaking to members of the public, there is a question of whether or not this is all necessary. A lot of countries around the world are still struggling with economic woes post-COVID. There's lots of reasons linked to that. Latvia is not immune to that itself either. And so there are questions from the general public, you know, should the government really be thinking about how to manufacture more weapons and guns and artillery at a point where there are many other concerns that the general public have about living and working and surviving, essentially. There's a big question about whether or not something like conscription is necessary, whether this is overdoing it or not doing enough. This is something that a lot of people have questions about. In a way, there's no way to know. I mean, we're talking about trying to look into a crystal ball and trying to guess what might happen. There are signs that point to the fact that Russia could continue to be more aggressive, but nothing's a given. Things change very quickly in terms of foreign affairs, in terms of global affairs. But there is this divide, I would say, that I have observed in Latvia and also in other countries when you're talking about NATO and dealing with Russia, that at more senior levels in government, for instance, there is a lot of thinking about what could happen, how to be ready versus the general public, which is to a certain extent questioning whether or not it's too much and whether this kind of preparation might actually tip the scales and push Russia to act in a way that it may not otherwise. And this is, again, a question that cannot be answered today. All countries can really do is to prepare to the level they think is necessary.
Sophia Jan, thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Finally today, we travel south to the Caucasus and the tense, violent border between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Senior foreign correspondent Roland Oliphant talks us through the history, context, and latest developments in the region. Thank you so much for your time, Roland. Before we talk about the latest developments in Azerbaijan and Armenia, could you just give us some of the history and the context here for our listeners?
Okay, so Armenia and Azerbaijan were both republics of the Soviet Union. Until the Soviet collapse, Armenia is historically a Christian nation. Azerbaijan is a part of the broader kind of Turkic family of nations and Muslim. They're kind of side by side, Armenia on the kind of western side of the Southern Caucasus, Azerbaijan on the right-hand side against the Caspian Sea. And there's a lot of history here, but in a nutshell, around about the Soviet collapse, when it became clear that there were going to be independent countries, there was an enormous war between the two of them because populations were mixed up, basically. So there was an enormous war from 1988 to 1994. So actually began before the collapse of the Soviet Union, roughly 30,000 casualties, hundreds of thousands of refugees. And at the end of that, Armenia ended up with control of a place called Nagorno-Karabakh, which was inside the internationally recognized borders of Azerbaijan, but it ended up as a de facto, it was a self-declared unrecognized republic. ethnic Armenian were cleared out of there. It should be said there was a pretty grim ethnic cleansing by both sides in this war. So that remained a sore point and a frozen conflict for going on 30 years, essentially. You essentially had a kind of balance of power where Armenia was, again, this is very rough kind of drawing on the back of a cigarette packet kind of stuff. You don't want to try and base your PhD on what I'm saying, right? But basic things, Armenia was a client of Russia. The Russians had and still have border guards there, a large military base there. And that was meant to be Armenia's guarantee. And the Azerbaijanis were supported by Turkey, with whom they have close ethnic ties. And both the Turks and the Russians saw these clients as ways of balancing one another in the region. That kind of status quo held out for years. It was always tense. It was always a source of resentment and hatred. And then in 2020, the Azerbaijani government launched an offensive which defeated the Armenians, basically seized back control of a large chunk of Nagorno-Karabakh. Comprehensive Azerbaijani victory. So it kind of reversed the previous narrative, which is the Armenians had won the previous war. That ended with a ceasefire, brokered by largely by the Russians, under which there was meant to be a corridor between mainland Armenia and what was left of Nagorno-Karabakh, guaranteed by Russian peacekeepers. The Azerbaijanis kind of astroturfed. It was an environmental protest, basically blockaded the road. That blockade was there for about 9 months. The Armenians were saying, they're trying to starve us out. They're trying to starve us out. They're trying to lay the ground for a final solution here. The Azerbaijanis denied it. And then September last year, sure enough, they launched another very quick military operation, lasted about 24 hours. Azerbaijan overran Nagorno-Karabakh. The entire Armenian population basically left. It's about 100,000 people moving into Armenia. And that was the end. In theory, that was the end of that dispute. And both sides, actually, after that, Azerbaijan and Armenia, both said, okay, now we want to sign, finally, a big peace treaty. And theoretically, that's where we are right now. We are in the zone of the peace process, but things are very fragile.
Why only theoretically? Why are they still so fragile if we're supposed to be at a point where both sides might be able to sit down and talk?
I think if you, in my kind of cynical assessment of the world, I think it's because Azerbaijan has absolute military, economic, diplomatic, political dominance here. And there's really nothing to stop them pushing forward if they want to take more, right? So normally, it's difficult to think of an example in history where the winning side in a long conflict who has dominance just stops out of the goodness of their hearts kind of thing. At least that's what the view is from Armenia, right? The Azerbaijanis absolutely deny that. I should say that the Armenians fear that the Azerbaijanis have now ambitions on Armenia proper. And there's been a lot of rhetoric coming out. They point to a lot of rhetoric coming out from President Aliyev of Azerbaijan, where he talks about and has talked up for a long time the concept of, he talks about parts of Armenia as Western Azerbaijan. He talks about how a lot of Azerbaijanis lived there before the Soviet Union. Sometimes they talk about how even Yerevan was once an Azerbaijani city. There's all these kinds of historical things that make the Armenians worried. There's disputes about transport corridors. There's an exclave of Azerbaijan on the other side of, on kind of sandwiched between Armenia and Turkey. And the Azerbaijanis want access to that. The Armenians kind of fear that's going to be an excuse for a land grab. And there's also unresolved disputes about other little exclaves that both sides hold in each other's countries from that early war in the 90s, which they're having to resolve. So theoretically, on paper, both sides are saying, and they said from, I think, December last year, we are absolutely committed to finally putting an end to this and signing a peace treaty based on the borders of 1991, the borders we inherited from the Soviet Union. The Armenians fear that the Azerbaijanis aren't negotiating good faith about that and they're pushing as far as they can. The Azerbaijanis feel that the Armenians are making up all kinds of excuses not to deliver on stuff they occupied 30 years ago.
How did Azerbaijan come to be in such a dominant position? And why is Armenia at this point so weak?
It's basically about money, I think. So Armenia is landlocked and mountainous and small and doesn't have a huge amount of natural resources. Azerbaijan sits on the Caspian Sea and has a lot of oil. I mean, a lot of oil. So Azerbaijan has got richer and richer over the past 30 years. And Baku's kind of been, transformed into an oil-rich capital, all of this kind of stuff. President Aliyev has used that to, you know, kind of cement his own control as well. He's viewed outside Azerbaijan, I think, if it's fair to say, as an authoritarian leader. He's been in power for, I don't have the number of years to hand, but he doesn't brook much opposition, pretty appalling human rights record, all of those things. So Azerbaijan is richer, it's larger, it's also useful to both to Russia, but also to the West, because it borders Iran. So it's quite a close ally of Israel. I believe there's rumors about, I mean, probably somebody actually knows, you know, there's listening posts there looking at Iran, things like that. So it's an important ally from that side of the thing. And since the war in Ukraine began, that's become even more important, because Europe, trying to wean itself off Russian gas, has turned to Azerbaijan. And, you know, kind of Ursula von der Leyen going to Baku and praising Mr. Aliyev as a reliable partner and expanding gas deliveries, all this kind of thing. Also with that happening, like suddenly with Russia in this massive confrontation with the West, first of all, it's preoccupied in Ukraine, so it's not really in a position to back up its ally in Armenia. But also, you know, the relationship with Turkey, for example, with President Erdogan, is more important to Putin than it has been for a long time, because he's a NATO member who has a lot of potential to cause Russia problems in the Black Sea. And so Armenia is a relatively easy pawn to sacrifice. That's the feeling you get, at least in Yerevan, when you talk to Armenians. They feel that that's how they're being treated by Moscow.
You've spoken to some of the key players in this conflict. Can you tell us about your interview with, was it the Armenian Prime Minister?
I went to see Nikol Pashinyan in Yerevan last month. It was quite a challenging interview, to be absolutely honest. He was extremely carefully spoken. He didn't want to say anything that could be construed as aggressive or upsetting the peace process or anything else. And that would kind of surprise me, because in my reporting around this and my preparation for this, talking to people like, okay, what's the situation and so on, I'd basically been told by multiple sources, look, like there is a genuine danger, and it's genuinely felt in Yerevan, that the Azerbaijanis are prepping for potentially a war against Armenia proper, another land grab, and that they're genuinely worried about that. Speaking to me, he would not be drawn on that. He repeated his criticisms of comments that President Aliyev has made. President Aliyev gave this rambling interview in January, I think it was January 10th. And I understand that's what rattled the Armenians, because he started talking in that about how the maps that the Armenians want to use are not fair, like, because they're late Soviet maps. And actually, if you want to be politically consistent, you should go back to the beginning of the Soviet Union, when we had a lot of land elsewhere and so on and so forth. So, and kind of saying, I reserve the right to act if Armenia seem to rearm and all of this. And I spoke to Armenian sources who said, look, we feel like that is rhetoric that's laying the groundwork, that's laying the rhetorical groundwork for an excuse for a future land grab. But he was very careful speaking to me, and spoke in very carefully chosen diplomatic phrases. And his basic message was, look, I remain completely committed to the peace process. The Azerbaijanis have also said that they're committed to a peace process. Maybe like Aliyev is saying this stuff in rhetorically, but that doesn't change what their official position is. And as long as their official position remains that, then they should stick to it, and so on. And, you know, I mean, he kind of made the point also that, like, where I am gives me a kind of unique perspective on the state of the world, because being caught between all these different alliances and these different countries, I have to speak to the leaders of basically both sides. If there's going to be a nuclear war, I'm speaking to the various sides in that. So, you know, I have a different sense of how things are from that perspective. We're actually a lot safer here than you are anywhere else. I've spoken to kind of the diplomats on either side to listen to them and their sources. Had a long conversation with Elin Sulaymanov, who's Azerbaijan's ambassador to London, saw my interview with Pashinyan. I was like, right, you've got to talk to me. So I went and spoke to him at the embassy. He was repeating, I think, the official Azerbaijani position. And the thing he really wanted to say, as soon as I turned the recorder on, he said, right, we have no plans to invade Armenia. Why would we do that? What is the point? Absolutely, that is the message the Azerbaijanis want to get out. This is nonsense. We're not planning to do it. And their kind of narrative is, look, for 30-odd years, the Armenians basically occupied our territory. We took it back. That's resolved. The president has said that chapter is over, and now we want peace, and that's what we want. And all this other stuff is you know, this is the Armenians trying to wriggle out of stuff and things like that. So very strong denial from the Azerbaijanis. That's what they're planning to do.
So you've been in the middle of the briefing war from both sides. Where do you think the truth lies?
I mean, I think because I have a fairly dim view of the realities of power in this world, because the balance of power is so clearly on the Azerbaijani side, I can completely understand why the Armenians are very nervous, because they're basically entirely vulnerable. And if you look at the way the kind of negotiations are going, the Armenians are making concession after concession because I don't think they feel like they have much choice. For example, one of the outstanding issues is there are these four Azerbaijani villages on the border that the Armenians have occupied since the 30 years ago and so on. So that's another thing the Azerbaijanis want back. The Armenians were holding out, hoping that there was going to be a swap for, there's about 215 square kilometers of Armenian territory that the Azerbaijanis occupied, like real mainland Armenian territory that the Azerbaijanis occupied in 2022. So they've come across the border at several points, and the Azerbaijanis have set up observation posts. They're inside Armenia already, basically. The Armenians were hoping that they could get a swap here, but last week, Pashinyan went to these border villages and said, look, our policy is we must prevent a war. We must not allow war to start. If we say to the Azerbaijanis not going to do anything, then we could face an attack, quote, by the end of the week. When I was speaking to Mr. Suleymanov, I said, look, like, there's nothing to stop you. Like, if you decided to do this and to enter Armenian territory, who's going to stop you? Like, your militaries are much stronger. You've got much stronger diplomatic cover. You're economically much stronger. Like, you could, and he said, well, yes, we could do it. We're not going to. We're absolutely not going to. But he admitted, like, we are in a much stronger position. So you can look at it two ways, really. You can look at it in a negotiation. The dominant side is going to push and push to get it. The best thing at the end of the day, people in Armenia have said to me, you could look at it as they're looking to take more and they've got broader ambitions and they know that we are vulnerable.
Final question from me really is, where are Armenia's friends? Do they have any?
So this is the really tricky thing. So I think Azerbaijan finds itself with a lot of friends at the moment, right? For example, before the operation that took place to take Nagorno-Karabakh, there were lots of airlifts from Israel coming in. Like, the Israelis are known to provide them with a lot of weapons because they're an important ally for the Israelis, for obvious reasons that we've already talked about. The energy relationship with Europe. Also, both Armenia and Azerbaijan, they've both sent aid to Ukraine. But there's definitely a sense that, yeah, there's a sense in Yerevan that Moscow is listening more sympathetically to the Azerbaijanis because they see more upside to it the moment. And so, yeah, where are Armenia's friends? To come back to that question, it's a really tricky situation. So Russia remains Armenia's most important security ally. They've still got a massive army base in southern Armenia. They still guard a lot of the borders. They have been a member of the CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which was kind of Russian-led NATO. But since this all happened, Pashinyan has made no secret of the fact that he feels that Russia didn't live up to its obligations for whatever reason. He said to me, we may review our future security arrangements. He did frame that. He did stress that, look, we're not choosing between sides here. We're just diversifying. But since then, he's made moves to kick the Russian border guards out of Yerevan Airport. There's going to be a meeting with, I think it's Antony Blinken and Ursula von der Leyen next month. The Azerbaijanis have said that shows Western bias and so on. So there's this question of whether Pashinyan is trying to make a full switch towards the West, as it were, in the middle of this huge new Cold War, or whether he can walk a line. And the thing is, Pashinyan is a Westernizer. He came to power as on the back of kind of anti-corruption protests, pro-European protests. He's always said his goal is to bring Armenia into Europe. So in a sense, he's been that way for a long time. He's previously gone out of his way not to annoy the Russians, not to alienate them. But the Russians are clearly quite annoyed, and they're not making a secret of that either. So can Armenia continue to stay on the fence or not? Or can it afford not to come off it? It's a really tricky situation.
Roland, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important for our listeners to hear?
I mean, if you're getting to the nuts and bolts of this, so there's a number of stumbling blocks for the peace process. The big one really is demarcation of the border. And we've talked about these different exclaves in different places. Now, a lot of the former Soviet republics, countries have not demarcated their borders. Doesn't mean the border's not there, you kind of agree it, but it's a long process, it takes a long time. This is really tricky because once you, as we said, you've got Azerbaijani troops kind of occupying some little spots of Armenia, Armenians on the other side, where is that border actually going to be drawn? And the Armenians obviously fear that they're going to fall out, but that's really got to be done. There's the Azerbaijanis want the Armenians to change their constitution, the Declaration of Independence, things like that, which claim some Azerbaijani territory. So there's pressure to do that. And then there's this big question about transport corridors. So Azerbaijanis are absolutely insisting on the Armenians giving them full access to this Azerbaijani exclave between Turkey and Armenia. The Armenians are terrified. That's a stalking horse, that if they give the Azerbaijanis what they want, which is kind of like completely free access and so on, then they're surrendering sovereignty of their territory and it'll end up getting cut up. They've come up with a counter proposal about kind of generally opening up a regional railway and road links, things like that. You can speak to either side. I challenge anybody to sit in a room with one of their diplomats and then go to the other side's diplomat, and you'll come away thinking, oh, they both sound completely reasonable. But these things quickly get bogged down in kind of minutiae, right? It's the kind of thing that you'll see very long academic or diplomatic papers written about in kind of journals about the, you know, something or other place and whether a road should go that way or that way and so on. And really, it should only really bother kind of area studies professors and diplomats. But that's the kind of thing that if it goes wrong and isn't resolved, could lead to another conflagration. So those are the knotty things that they're trying to resolve at the moment.
Roland, thank you so much.
That's all for Battle Lines this time. Please join us again next week for more of The Telegraph's best foreign reporting. Goodbye.
Battle Lines is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our news, analysis and dispatches from around the world, subscribe to The Telegraph or sign up to Dispatches, which brings stories from our award-winning correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a live blog on our website where you can follow updates on Israel and Gaza as they come in throughout the day, including insight from contributors to this podcast. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Battle Lines on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it really helps others find the show. As disinformation is a particular problem during conflict, we are relying on your support more than ever. Battle Lines is part of wider Telegraph foreign coverage in our podcasts. If you're interested in finding out more about the war in Ukraine, you can listen to our sister podcast, Ukraine the Latest. Battle Lines is produced by David Degahi, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.